Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Oh, hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. And we got a really cool episode for you today. This episode is our questions and answers episode. We have gotten from my students, some listeners, questions that I will do the best I can in answering for you today about improv, career, and life. And if you'd like to submit questions in the future for future question and answers episodes, all you need to do is go to jimcrane@gmail.com. But before we start, I want to introduce you somebody. You've heard his name on this program many times, Dan Schiffmacher, the guy who makes me sound so slick and so professional. You wouldn't be hearing my voice right now without Dan. And now here's his voice. Welcome, Dan,
to the
podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is going to be fun.
Yes. And actually, I don't want to take credit for this. This was your idea.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I figure I also help manage the Facebook page. So, like, we get people sending in questions. It's like, well, I'm going to do an episode and, kind of, I guess, give back to the improv community.
And, you know, I move slowly. It's very sad that I'm an improviser and I teach Yes And, but I know I move very slowly. When did you have this idea and when did we bring this, or you really, when did it come to fruition?
Well, I think we're recording in June. I think I mentioned this maybe March or February?
Of 2015, I think.
Oh,
so it's
maybe. Well, it's the art of slow comedy is your thing, so it's on brand.
Great. That's all that matters as long as it's on brand. If it wasn't for you and Lauren and Sam Bowers, who knows where Improv Nerd would be. We do have about 4 listeners. So I want to thank you guys. So here's how this one will work. Dan will ask me a question. I will answer it. And it's a very simple format, right, Dan?
Yeah, if we have anything to discuss about it, we'll talk about it.
We'll discuss it, sure. You know, we'll bat it back and forth and see how it goes. Also, Dan is an up-and-coming improviser. He's been improvising in Chicago for, 5 or 6 years now?
3 or 4 years in Chicago, but altogether about 8 or 9 years.
So he's very accomplished.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
All right. So we're ready. Dan, the first question.
All right. So the first question, and we'll credit everybody at the end who submitted questions. Thank you again.
Now, if I don't want to answer a question, can I pass?
If you want to.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
Sure.
All right.
First thing I got, what's the best thing about teaching improv and what's the best thing about performing improv for you?
Okay. So to me, the best thing about teaching improv that I love is I love getting a group of people, and it doesn't matter if it's a 1-day workshop or if it's a 6-week or 18-week, class, is getting a group of people that don't know each other to get them. I don't get them to do it. I'm not that powerful. To have them become vulnerable and do really slow, grounded scene work and make them feel like they belong. Because to me, when I was starting out at improv, that was the thing that really drew me to improv. I think I've said this before in the podcast, but I was like this fat, I was 300 pounds, insecure, sarcastic teenager who started improv. And when I got to my first class at the Players Workshop of the Second City here in Chicago, back in the 80s sometimes, where there was just very few places teaching improv, everything that I had been punished for or in my family or in school, I was now being rewarded. And I found my people. And if I can give that in a class or a workshop, that people like feel connected and there's a sense of community, that's what I love about that. In terms of performing, it's funny because Lauren said to me the other day, she's like, you know what? You put a lot of pressure on yourself to perform. And there's no question. I've been doing this for so long, but I still put a lot of pressure on myself, which is awful as an improviser. It just takes the joy out of it. But as you guys know, I take the joy out of most things. I like it when I'm working with people that are better than me and get me out of my comfort zone. I think about like Jay Succo, who's like got this great positive energy, or Dan Bacadol, who's just a very strong improviser and you just want to follow him. Those are the things, Ian John Hildreth, who makes really strong choices and you're just going to follow him. It's those kind of, that's what I really like. People forcing me out of what I typically play.
Like Stacey Smith or any of those musical improv.
Musical improv does it as well, where I'm scared. Like I'm really, really scared. And I really enjoy that.
I think that's pretty great too. I'm someone who loves to plan things, but like, I think that improv for me is also that kind of release where it's just like, I'm on stage and I don't have to worry about anything. We'll figure it out. And, it's something I just don't, I guess, normally do in normal life, I guess. But cool. So we got a second question. Let's see. How long did it take you to feel like you developed an improvisational voice for yourself?
So I started, like I said, at 18 years old, I went to the Players Workshop in Second City. Mm-hmm. And I took those classes. And then from there, I went to Second City. And then I went to IO, but it was called Improv Olympic then. And then about 9 years later, I was at the Annoyance Theater. So I was 27 years old. And we were doing shows at the Annoyance Theater where they would do plays and musicals that were scripted through improvisation. The process was really fun. It was basically, you'd get up there, you'd improvise, and you had to remember what you had done the previous rehearsal. And there were shows that they didn't even have scripts, you know, and they had been running for a long time. Now, and understudies actually would have to watch a grainy VHS copy to get the dialogue down.
Wow.
So I did a show. I'd done a couple shows there, and I did a show with a director, Gary Redoran, called I'm 27, I Still Live at Home and Sell Office Supplies. And I was really influenced by the work I had done with Del Close, which was truth and comedy. Like, you could get up there and just tell a story, and people were going to laugh. You didn't have to embellish it. Mm-hmm. And that show was probably 75-80% all true. And some things certainly were heightened. And I found my voice in that show. That was after 9 years. And then when I went back to I was improvising because I was doing Jazz Freddy and some other Gambrinus and some other improv shows. I would always be, my improv, I always felt, was stronger because I was doing that. And I think, you know, as I'm older now, and I'll go and I'll do a storytelling night, or I'll go and do, I took a stand-up class and did some open mics. It's funny how you can find your voice by going out and doing other things, doing some sketch, and then coming back to improv. It makes your voice that much clearer and that much stronger.
Wow, that's great. That's cool that you...
I think another thing too, Dan, is like, for me, is like your voice is always... it's always evolving. Like, life experience
for sure
helps it. And I think also, like, you know, like, I've always been like, you know, I love to play low status. I love to play dark. I love to play, you know, the low, depressing emotion. But, I think the more you can evolve your improv mm-hmm. voice, the more fun it's going
to
be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people relate to that. I remember before I got into the improv community in Rochester, 5 years ago or whatever, you came to Rochester to do a workshop.
Yeah.
I wasn't there for it, but I heard people were telling stories of like how you ran a workshop and the prompt was like a dark prompt, and that person, whoever got it, just started doing a scene that didn't really involve the prompt, but you stopped the practice. It was like, so why didn't you do that? Like, why aren't you? So like, I think that style and that voice is definitely an interesting one. But that definitely had an impact on those people around there, because it's just like, oh yeah, if it's, you know, that's kind of what you have to deal with. It's not everything is like, you know, happy and gamey or something.
Right.
But cool. Let's go to a third question. Who do you think is the best improviser you played with and why?
I think, to me, it is the best person I ever played with. There's a lot of great people I play with, but the one that I had a great time with and learned a lot was Stephanie Ware.
Okay.
And I think Stephanie Ware, we did a show called Naked, and this was back in the 90s when people weren't really doing two-person duo shows.
Mm-hmm.
And we did one long scene for 1 hour. And what Stephanie, certainly she was a very generous improviser. She was a great improviser. She also had great characters that had emotional range to it. And she was she had a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant mind. And I love playing with her so much. And the other thing, too, is like I've played with a lot of great people over the years, and there's this thing called chemistry, and some people you have chemistry automatically with, and we had that at least at that show, or Stephanie and I did with that show, and some people they can be the best improvisers in the world, and you just might not have that chemistry with.
Yeah.
But I would say, if you ever asked me the best person I ever played with, it would be hands down Stephanie Ware. She's got everything. Everything, everything, everything.
Have you ever thought about doing? I mean, she lives doesn't live in Chicago
anymore. She lives in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever thought about reuniting or anything?
Yes, I thought they're going to ask me for Chicago Improv Festival, or we'll put it together for a festival, and I'd love to do it, but I'd be intimidated by it because she's just so freaking good. Huh. You know.
Okay. Cool. Fourth question, what have you seen in fellow improvisers or students who've become successful that you knew when you're looking at them that they were going to make it?
Well, I think the thing is, I don't think you ever know if somebody's going to make it. You know, I think about, it's really a hard thing to predict, but you do know people that have something a little differently than other people. And I think about Adam McKay.
Yeah.
Adam McKay was just a brilliant improviser. He was he had a great imagination. He knew how to play a game. But what Adam had with putting together A Pinata Full of Bees, which was a Second City review, and it was a review that really revolutionized Second City. It was the beginning of their Renaissance period. He was a leader. He was somebody everybody followed. And so he took that and his talent, and he was able to parlay it into this great film directing career, and he won an Oscar. I look at a guy like Dave Koechner, who I worked with at I.O., and we did Jazz Freddy and some other projects together. Dave was a guy who was very focused. He had a lot of confidence. And he also, he also had a ton of talent. But I think a lot of times people, think talent is the overall thing, but I think it's more than talent. It's drive, it's confidence, it's vision, that makes it. And when I see students, are they hungry? Are they hungry to learn to be good? Not I want to be famous or I want some end result. Are they looking to get better? Those are the people usually to me. And are they putting themselves out there? Are they creating their own shows? Are they getting up and doing open mics? Are they asking a lot of questions? Are they emailing me with a lot of questions? Are they taking opportunities? Are they going to festivals?
To learn and grow.
To learn and grow and get better. Those are the people. And you know what? Because I've seen people who've not had a ton of talent, at the beginning and have developed it. And then I've seen people that have tons of talent and just fizzle out.
Wow. Okay. Cool. So basically just kind of keep, as long as someone has the drive and stuff like that, that's kind of what you look for.
Well, yeah, it's a passion. It's an excitement about it, that's what I've seen.
Okay. Cool. Now, next question. Why are emotions important in improv?
Well, first of all, in improv, we're reflecting life. We're artists up there, so we want to show life, and we all have emotions. And emotions are so universal because we all have them. We're all angry. We're all happy. We're all sad. We're all afraid. So we can see ourselves in those emotions. In terms of a practical thing, I think emotions really connect the player with the audience. In terms of just a technical part, if you can start your scene with an emotion, let's say it's you're happy. So everything you say to me makes me happy, even if it's something really sad or whatever. So throw out a line to me.
It's any line at all?
Yeah, that you think would be sad, and I'm supposed to be a real upbeat, happy person.
Just got back from the vet. I had to put my dog down after 10 years.
Oh, my God, congratulations. You had the dog for 10 years. That's the longest relationship you've ever had.
Huh. Yeah.
I got you something.
What?
It's a 10-year coin.
What? Did you know this was going to...
Yeah. Yeah, your dog was looking a little sickly, and I'm like,
you've been holding on to it for a bit. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I thought he was going to die last week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I never really thought about it like that. That I had them for 10 years, and most people don't have golden retrievers for that long because of their genetic problems. And
now
stuff.
Karen can move in.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, because she was allergic.
Yeah.
So, wow. Yeah, I guess
and
this
I
is
be
this...
your best man.
Let's move in first.
Wait. Yeah. Sure.
But sure. And I mean, you get this coin. And...
I wrote out the speech that I'm going to say.
You are prepared. Yeah. Right. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I don't have to audition. I'm in, right?
No, of course. Of course. Cool. You're my best. Yeah. Cool. Why not? Yeah, of course. Yeah. You're the only one who knows about the dog. I haven't even told Karen yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See? Thanks, man. That means a lot. No. Wait. Don't walk away from me. Oh. That means a lot to me.
Oh, good. Good.
You told me before Karen, because come on.
I've known you for longer, right?
Since high school.
Come on.
Wrestling.
Yeah. You get close in those kind of matches, you know? You can't. It's been a year for Karen, and she's great.
Oh, I love
Karen. She's great.
I
say she's going to love that old Rusty's gone, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. This is a new day.
Okay, so I had a point of view. So anything you gave me, I was going to be happy about it. That, for the most part, got me out of my head.
Yeah.
So it's like object work. A lot of people are like, object work, and they kind of put it down. But I believe that object work is there, starting an activity, you're frying an egg or whatever, is to get you out of your head. And I think emotions, this is a pure technical thing, is to get you out of your head.
Cool. That was great. All right.
That felt good, Dan. Yeah, that really felt good.
That was fun.
Yeah.
Rusty was my uncle's old dog. He was a golden retriever.
Oh, wow.
A little truth there for that.
Truth in comedy, right there.
There you go.
Dan tapped into his life experience. He didn't even know it.
Right. Okay, cool. Another question here. When you're pretty secure in your career and you know those who seem to be having real difficulty with their work and you can see it's probably their attitude, not their ability, should you relate times when you had your doubts about yourself to show empathy or to tell them what you think about their attitude holding them back?
Well, I don't think there's no should. And I don't think you can go up to somebody and say, unless they're looking for it. And that, like in my class and in my workshops, I always say, do you want feedback? I try to do that because I want people to, in a way, give me, we're working together. So do you want my feedback or not?
Yeah.
So we're working together and I don't want to be cramming my ideas down your throat. So if somebody came to me and said, Jimmy, things aren't, I'm doing really well, but, I don't know what's holding me back. If they address that, then I would share my experience, strength and hope around that thing. And we talked about talent isn't the only thing. And I think people put way too much importance on the talent. And I don't think they put enough emphasis on you got to be a nice person. And that doesn't mean you're a doormat. Mm-hmm. That means you're kind and nice to everybody. So I've seen people that nobody likes to work with because they're assholes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very short list. We all know who the people are, and it gets around. I don't care what community you're in, it gets around.
Yeah.
So that, in improv, people have less tolerance for it because it's such a personal art form. If you have a bad attitude and you ask me for that, I hope to God I would be honest with you and say, yeah, you got a bad attitude and I would share my experience around it.
Yeah, I think that's also important for people doing improv. I mean, for me at least, I love to get notes regardless if it's a bad note or a good note because I want to improve and I want to, learn and grow, whether it's writing or improv or anything like that too, so...
Well, and I think the sad thing is sometimes, and I know certainly I was probably a jerk. I know I was a jerk. Like when I was doing Jazz Freddy, I wasn't easy to work with because my dad was going to prison at that time, and I was going through a really hard time and put a lot of pressure on myself because I wanted to be discovered and wanted to be famous and all that. And certainly in Naked, I've talked about it on the podcast. I was really jealous of Stephanie's talent, and so. All of that stuff interferes with it, but nobody will speak to it. That's the thing. you know,
yeah.
And that's really hard because had someone pulled me aside, I don't know if I would have listened back then in my 20s, but at least you would have got, it would have helped. And I think sometimes, like, if somebody's talented and they're an asshole, they're given a lot of license and end up, in some cases, becoming successful, but in other cases, they hang themselves.
Well, okay, cool. Let's see, we got another one. Let's see, I've been doing improv for a long time. Why should I keep taking classes?
Well, this is a really good one. And I just want to say that doesn't mean, because you always want to get better at it. You know, like, I wish I had time to take class, improv classes for my teaching, because I want to learn new games. I want to learn, you know, different approaches and stuff like that, so I can incorporate that into my teaching. I don't have time. We just had Betsy, and it's crazy. You always want to be inspired. You always want to get new ideas. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, like, if you're like, oh, I'm burnt out on improv, I don't want to take improv classes, I'm doing a show a couple times a week, I'm fine with that. Find an acting class, find a painting class, find a photography class, find another class that's going to challenge you, mm-hmm. you know, go out and do an open mic night, do a stand-up class, do a sketch writing class, but you want to always be working on yourself. You know, it never stops. It never freaking stops.
See how you can, like, flex that creative muscle a little bit. Like, I know that, like, when I was kind of tired of doing improv, I kind of switched over to doing production stuff, but I still, you know, incorporate improv into that, and you still kind of learn things from that. So yeah, there's so much out there to just still learn and look for and stuff, I guess. Cool. Let's see, we've got another question here. I've attended a few of your workshops, and you do an exercise I call the trust circle of vulnerability circle. I call the trust circle or vulnerability circle. It's a great exercise, and I'm wondering how you came up with it and how you are able to assess the people can handle the questions in that.
Well, I was teaching a workshop with a wonderful teacher, Liz Allen, and she had brought the game in to our workshop called the Individual Assessment Workshop. And so basically, if you don't know the game, people are all standing in a circle. You put somebody in the middle. And then how I do it is, it has evolved over the years. You will face one of the partners, and I will, one of the partners in the circle, and then you will say, I will ask an honest question, like, favorite childhood memory?
Playing Nintendo with my dad.
Great. So then you'll move down to the next person, but I'll continue to ask you a question. Biggest sixth thing you're most proud of?
I don't know. Thing I'm most proud of, graduating college.
Great. Next. You're a good friend because?
I listen.
Next. You're a bad friend because?
I'm a bad friend because I don't know why I'm a bad friend.
Great. One thing you don't want us to know about you.
Don't want me to know about you. Don't want
one thing you don't think we would know about you.
Don't you think we would know about you?
Yeah, that you'd like to reveal. It doesn't have to be earth shattering.
Yeah. Well, I love dark scenes and dark improv.
Great. Another thing you don't want us to know about you.
I am a little too neurotic when it comes to planning and organizing.
Great. And finally, one more thing you don't want us to know about.
Let's see. I'm gullible. I'm naive.
Okay, great. So then we'd all clap for you, and then somebody else would come in the middle, and then they'd face somebody in the circle, and I would continue to ask those questions. So that's the game. All right. What was the question that?
It was how you came up with it. And how are you able to assess the people that can handle the questions? Like, how do you pick the people that, does it just go along in a circle, or is it?
Well, sometimes it's spontaneous, get in the circle. Sometimes I'll ask certain people to start. Mm-hmm. So I'm not in control of the game. People just get in there and they do it. Now, what I've seen happen a lot, which is really helpful to the scene work, is people will get there and they will tear up. They will reveal something, and they will start to cry. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes, you know, when I go out of town or even in Chicago, you teach a workshop, people are like, oh, you're going to make somebody cry. I'm not that powerful.
Yeah.
It does happen where that comes up. And mm-hmm. what's great about that is, I believe, is they're tapping into sadness for the whole group, that, and they can access it for the whole group. And what that does is it makes people vulnerable, which is really a great place to start. It brings them together, builds support and trust, and it opens them up. That this isn't, you know, if we can be vulnerable, we are going to connect with our scene partner on stage on a so much different level. And our scenes are going to be richer, and they're going to be more memorable, and they are going to be funnier, like mm-hmm. in like watching a good movie or watching a good play.
Wow. Okay, cool. That's a great answer. I never had to think about three things I don't want people to know before.
Yeah, I know. Yes, you were blushing.
I'll keep it in the episode. I won't edit it out.
Okay, great.
Okay, another question we have. I'm not enjoying the classes that I'm taking at blank, but it's a well-known school. How long do I stick with it?
Okay, I think you got to, you know, this is, everything's individual. So why aren't you having a good time? Is it, do you not like the style of what they're teaching? Is it very competitive? Are you putting a lot of pressure on yourself? Is there a big class? But you don't have to, just because you started a program, you don't have to finish it. Like, I teach three levels of Art of Slow Comedy. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of people who will start the first class. There's always an attrition rate. You know, I don't start with 14 people and it usually end up with the same 14 people. I'll have a core of people. So people do drop out. If you are not having fun, and again, you have to figure out for yourself, why aren't you having fun? Is it the style? Is it you know, the competitive nature of it? Is it the size of it? Is it the people? Is it the teacher? But if you are not having fun with it, then I would say find a place. And now more than ever, there are places outside of these big institutions where you can experience the same thing I did when I first started, when it was very small, where you can find your tribe. Is that musical improv? Is that slow improv? Is that genre-based improv? It's out there. So, you know, going to these schools are really good because it's helping you find what it is, what kind of improv that you like doing.
Yeah, I mean, and that kind of goes to what we said earlier, is that you have to, well, you kind of find your voice. And
look, if you're not having fun and you've given it a try, you don't have to finish a program. You certainly don't have to finish my program or any other program. Go and find somewhere. Ask your friends where they're having fun at doing improv, and go and try a class. Because the thing is, if you start a level at one of the big schools, you can always go back there.
That's true.
And a lot of times, you know, people will go back mm-hmm. there, and they'll be more successful when they go back there, because maybe they're putting pressure on themselves, or maybe they're getting pressure in their head about the institution.
Fair enough. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's see. Let's move.
I'm hoping all these answers make sense, Dan.
Yeah, they,
that's
yeah.
what we're shooting
you're, yeah,
for.
You're doing. Yeah. You know, people take what they want from them. This kind of
and they leave the rest. Yeah,
this kind of plays off a little bit off that too. It's like, good. This next question: I'm feeling really bummed about improv. I don't enjoy it as much as I used to, but I feel that there's so much competition and so much turnover. If I step away, I'll miss my time to be discovered.
Improv is going nowhere. They said this when I was starting out. Improv is going nowhere. So, you know, I always had that fear, like, oh, if a play comes or something, I don't want to leave it because, just like this person's question is, I won't be discovered. So I think you got to throw that idea out, that there's a certain time for you being discovered, because I don't know if that really exists in improv, if you're going to be discovered.
Yeah.
I think that's there's some mythology there but improv, if you're not enjoying it, go away from it. Take a break. I'm such a big proponent of taking a break, and then come back, because it's not going to go anywhere, you know? And if you come in and you have a better attitude, your improv is going to be better.
Right, and if your improv's better, it increases your chance of being
getting discovered, which we can talk about. This discovered thing, I mm-hmm. guess for me, is like, just do your own shows, you know?
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
I've never seen anybody just make it on improv. I mean,
yeah, it's always kind of a tool or an additional thing to mm-hmm. to get discovered, so to speak. Yeah. So, okay, cool. Let's see. That was that. There's another question here. How do I know that I'm good enough to have a career in improv or in comedy?
Well, first of all, you have to define for yourself what making it or a career in improv is. And comedy. So if your goal is to be on Saturday Night Live or to write for television, that is something different than improv, you know. So decide what you want in terms of your career path. And then if it's improv, like I can only speak from my experience, I had to diversify. Like, and I think I've said this, you know, people are tired of hearing this, but when I started out in the 80s, the group that I hung out with, if you said, hey, I want to be a teacher or I want to be a director, people said, okay, you're giving up on your dream, because everybody wanted to be famous, you know? So I had to diversify. And so teaching was one thing. Teaching corporate stuff was another thing. Auditioning for films and television here in Chicago was another thing. You know, writing industrials, you know, when I was writing for Second City, it's like, you know, what are the other opportunities? For me right now, it's like, okay, if I don't have to work a day job, I've made it, you know? Now, I say that, but of course, you know me, I want more, I want to be famous and stuff like that. But when I'm really feeling good about myself, it's like, okay, I'm doing what I like to do. And you know, that's
making a living out of it.
I'm making a living out of comedy,
which is some people can't only dream to do that. So, yeah.
Cool. And the thing is, it's a lot easier than it was when I started out. There's more opportunities to teach, teach in improv schools. There's more opportunities for corporate stuff. You know, more people are leaving Chicago or New York or LA, like when you were in Rochester Law.
Torello
started a theater with John Thompson. John was from Chicago, Law was from New York. So there's many, many more opportunities in improv than when I started.
Yeah, cool. So another question here. Second City, as well as PARC, the Panic Anxiety Relief Center, have used improv to respond to anxiety as well as other diagnostic categories. While the data is growing, I'm not sure how reliable it is. What do you think of the idea of using improv as therapeutic intervention?
Well, I think it's a great idea. And there actually, Stephanie McCullough has organized, I think it's in September, and I believe I'll be speaking there, a conference here in Chicago for therapists that use improv. And I think it's great. I know for me, I'm not for everybody. I get it. My teaching is not for everybody. Artist slow comedy is not for everybody. I use things that 10 years of group therapy that I bring into my improv. And one thing that I really like to help people with is to speak their process. If they feel they're in their head, they feel triggered by some exercise, they feel angry at me because I gave them a side coaching, they're having a shame attack, I really encourage them to speak about that, because I never got to speak that. And a lot of times, if people are just given the permission, and this is more therapy probably than improv, if people are given the opportunity to say, you know what, I'm really afraid. Like, I wish when we started this, I would have been honest and said, you know what, I'm really afraid to do this, you know?
Yeah.
Because I don't want people to think that I'm an expert at this. Who am I to you know, give these improv answers? If you're allowed to do that, that's going to free something up in you. And so I really, you know, I use that in my teaching, because I never got that, you know, and I see that it's helped me, and I want to help, you know, I want to help people in my classes.
You wrote a book called Improv Therapy, didn't you? Or was it something?
Yes, it was called Improv Therapy. And it was really basically about the things that block us becoming the best improvisers we possibly can be.
Huh. Cool. And I guess we have one more question here.
Oh my God, this is going fast.
Yeah, it's been pretty good. Pretty.
You happy with it so far?
Yeah, I think it's just been real conversational. You had some really good answers, and I think we had a solid.
Have I surprised you with any of my answers?
I don't know about surprise, but like, you know, they've definitely been informative.
Okay.
But cool. So last question here: how do you feel you had to choose between career and family life. Where do you find you had to make sacrifices to make both successful?
Well, I think with the birth of Betsy, a lot of things have shifted. And one thing is, like, time has become, like, really more precious. So it's like, okay, well, what's really important? Do I want to be at a show real late at night, or do I want to be teaching? I used to travel around the country a lot more teaching workshops and doing an improv night. Well, if I'm going to do that, it's got to be worth my time. So right. I've become a lot more selective in that regard. In terms of sacrificing, you know, I'm going to say this, but I don't know how true it is. I think, like, you know, I've always wanted to move to Los Angeles. That was my goal. That was always my, like, if I move to Los Angeles, my life's going to be perfect. I'm going to become famous. I'm going to have a TV show. That didn't happen. I met Lauren. I got married to Lauren. We have a house. We have a kid now. We have a cat. You know, my life is never been better. So I don't, you know, at times I look at it as a sacrifice, but at other times, you know, I'm like, okay, it's kind of working out the way it's supposed to work out. Now, are there days where I'm frustrated? I'm like, oh my God, you know, all my friends are, you know, it seems like, you know, I watch Veep and it's everybody I started with, and then I feel bad about myself. But I think I'm pretty happy with my home life. I think in terms of career stuff, I don't know if I'll ever be happy with my career. But I don't feel like I don't think I've sacrificed it, because I feel like I've been, like, I'm afraid to go to L.A., you know, and I'm afraid to pick up my family and move to L.A. And I don't even know if L.A. would necessarily be the answer.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people from Chicago decide to go out there. Like, I know somebody recently who did improv here probably the same amount of time. She was here for like 3 or 4 years and then decided that, you know, I've been wanting to move to L.A., so I'm just going to do it. She quit her job and just went out there, you know, Wild West style, didn't really have another job lined up. And I don't, again, with me and the whole planning thing, I want to make sure that there's something there or a reason to do that. I know that, like, the film industry and stuff is bigger there, and I have some friends over there, but I don't know if that's, like, I like it here. You know, I've lived here to be 4 years now in a month or so, and I have no reason to want to move out otherwise yet. How do you think, you know, you've asked this question, I think, of Rachel Dratch and some others. How do you think improv has helped you become a father with Betsy so far?
Well, I think a lot of things, and I think I wrote a blog on this about, you know, I was playing with Betsy on the floor, and Lauren came in and is like, you hand her the blocks. You know, you need to play the blocks. This, you know, she was playing with little wooden blocks, and you need to play with the blocks in a certain way. Or I was pushing her on the swing, and Lauren was like, you know, don't push her that hard or whatever. So, and I was, you know, certainly that triggers me, and it just, it reminds me of, like, okay, you know, like, you know, and we, you know, Lauren and I talked about it. So, so I'm aware of that, because I grew up in a household, Dan, where it's like, you know, if you were having fun or you had joy, you had to hide it. You know, you had to hide it. If you got success, you had to hide it. And so, you know, I think Lauren and I are, like, a really good balance, because, you know, she's more structured. She's more like, she plans stuff, and I'm more spontaneous.
Yeah.
And I think also enjoying playing with Betsy. Like, you know, before we did this, I was laying on the floor and I was just enjoying playing with her. And that's what really improv is. It's like, we're just, when it's good, we're just enjoying playing, and we're not, like, worried if we made a mistake, or we're worried if you know, we're getting the rules or the so-called rules of improv right or any of that. We're just playing. I mean, before you came, you know, Betsy, we would stack up these blocks and she'd knock them over. And sometimes, you know, you think in your head, like, well, you know, I need the biggest block and the smallest block and whatever. And it's like, she doesn't care.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
she's going to knock anything over. And so that's made me be a better father, you know?
Cool. All right. Well, I mean, I think that's all the questions.
This is it?
Yeah,
okay, so I want to Just thank everybody who we took questions for. So we're kind of protecting your anonymity here in terms of like
who asked what,
who asked what, and stuff like that. So, but Heinrich Blick, I want to thank, and Margot S. Scott, and Patrick J. Forrester, and Tom Thorell, and Sarah Savage, and Anna Yee for their questions today on this episode of Improv Nerd. And Dan, I want to thank you for this wonderful idea. It'll be interesting to see what kind of feedback we get from this, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I think if anybody, again, wants to, if we want to keep doing more of these, we might do more. Just email Jimmy at jimcrane@gmail.com and ask, what is it about, ask questions about life or career or improv, right? Or...
career, life, improv, yeah, or the podcast. That would
be, make the podcast, or whatever you know you want to ask him about, and we'll try to answer it on air. And maybe at some point when Betsy starts talking, we'll get Betsy on.
We got to get Betsy on. She's going to be a bigger star than her old man, that's for sure. So thank you guys for listening, and until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my God.